You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, older scholarship held that the Book of Acts was somewhat of a legal brief given by Luke to Paul in the most excellent Theophilus. After all, Paul is on trial in Rome. At least one function would serve to exonerate Paul as he went up to Nero. That is what we're going to see so clearly here tonight. Over and over, Paul addresses these three figures, Felix, Festus, and Agrippa, and he's at pains to show that Christianity is not illegal. It isn't bad for society. It's good. It's a good thing, and he's done nothing wrong. Acts 23:12. The next morning, some Jews formed a conspiracy. They bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. Newsflash, they don't kill Paul. So did they all die of starvation? There was a law that if you made an oath but you couldn't fulfill it, you were exempt from it. Anyways, the irony here is that they're making an oath before God that is against God's will. To kill, to murder Paul. Terrible. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. 40 men against one Jesus. Let's see who wins. They went to the chief priests and the elders, and they said, "You and the Sanhedrin should ask the commander to bring Paul back to the council again. Pretend that you want to examine his case more fully, and we will kill him on the way." But when the son of Paul's sister, his nephew, heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and he told Uncle Paul. "I didn't know Paul had family in Jerusalem." Makes a certain amount of sense, though. I mean, he lived here and his family's there. Yeah, family would be there. Then Paul called one of the centurions over. "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." The commander took aside the young man by the hand. This word could be used for young men that were teenagers, but that description, holding the kid by the hand, probably a little boy. He drew him aside, and he asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" Paul's nephew said, "Some Jews are going to ask you to bring Paul before the IA council tomorrow, pretending that they want to get some more information. But don't do it. There are about 40 men hiding along the way, ready to ambush Paul and kill him." The commander dismissed the young man with this warning, "Don't tell anyone that you've told me this." Then the commander called two of his centurions and he ordered them, "Get 200 soldiers ready to leave for Caesarea to the north. We got to get them out of Jerusalem at 9 o'clock tonight, nighttime." So they would get him out under the cover of darkness. "And also take 200 spearmen and 70 mounted troops. If my calculations are correct, that is 470 troops compared to the 40 that were trying to get Paul. 10 to 1, guards to goons." So very typical of the Romans. They would overkill. Could you imagine being those 40? You know, religious guys, and you look up, and there's 470 Romans coming for you. Well, when the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they handed Paul over to Governor Felix. Governor Felix, our first leader that Paul speaks before. Governor Felix, who was he? He reigned as the governor over Judea, kind of like Pontius Pilate. This is later, though, AD 52 to 59. He had the high priest murdered, and he was widely hated by the Jewish people. Nobody liked this guy. He was a bad leader, pretty wicked. He had, according to Cornelius Tacitus, quote, "the power of a king with all the instincts of a slave." So he had all this authority. Problem is, he was an idiot, capricious, rude, mean-spirited. But he seems to understand Christianity to some degree. His wife, as we'll see, is Jewish. They're in Jerusalem. There's a huge burgeoning movement in Jerusalem of Christians. So there is some familiarity with this. How does Paul do? The governor, Felix, asked Paul what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. 5 days go by. The high priest went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. This is all boilerplate, legal, Roman practice. When Paul was called in, Tertullus, the lawyer, presented his case before Felix. Felix, Governor Felix, we have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Sort of true, he quelled a number of zealot rebellions that cropped up, according to Josephus. However, under his reign, there was some of the worst tyranny, some of the worst fighting and infighting going on until the Jewish War in AD 66. So you can almost hear Tertullus' lips puckering, kissing this guy's backside. Flattery. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. We have found this man to be a troublemaker. Poimas, pest, disease, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. That's what he's been doing, stirring up riots, yeah. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene cult and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges that we are bringing against him. The other Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. Proving these things were true? Asserting these things were true. Asserting. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation." See how different Paul's introduction is? He doesn't flatter. He doesn't lie. He's just like, "I know that you lead the nation." Okay, next. "So I gladly make my defense." So he shows a little bit of honor. No lying, no flattery. He says, "You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers didn't find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges that they are now making against me. But I admit that I follow the way of Jesus." Jesus said, John 14:6, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." So the most primitive form of Christianity referred to itself as the way of Jesus. "I admit I do follow the way of Jesus, which they call a cult. But I worship the God of our ancestors, and I firmly believe the Jewish law and everything written in the prophets." He's right in line with mainstream Judaism. There's nothing here that's out of line with what we read in the Old Testament. What we're reading here is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. That's his argument. Paul continues, "After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem and I brought my people gifts for the poor to present offerings." Riots? No. Ringleader? No. Cult? No. Gifts. For whom? The poor. That's who. "My accusers saw me in the temple as I was completing a purification ceremony." We already studied that. "There was no crowd. There was no rioting. But some Jews from the province of Asia, Ephesus, were there. And they ought to be here to bring charges if they have anything against me." Right. That is classic jurisprudence, to be able to face your accusers. Where are they? These eyewitnesses that saw me doing all these riots and leading this cult in Jerusalem, defiling the temple, desecrating everything. Where's the witnesses? They ought to be here. "Ask these men here what crime the Jewish High Council found me guilty of. Except for that one time I shouted out, "I am on trial before you today because I believe in the resurrection of the dead." So far, the prosecution, led by Tertullus, has been appealing to what? Flattery? "Oh, most excellent Felix, you're so amazing, so wonderful." That has nothing to do with the case. They've been appealing to assertions, not arguments. They got this confused back then. People get this confused today. Regularly, and I mean regularly, I talk to people that don't share my Christian views, and they think that it's just enough to give an assertion, and therefore they've won the argument. Do you know what I mean by that? Let me give you an example. There was one guy where I said, "What do you think about the origin of the universe, the Big Bang? All space, time, matter, and energy burst into existence from nothing. How do you explain that?" He said, "Well, I think that it was the universe caused itself." So I said, "All right, that's a nice assertion. What's the evidence that the universe could cause itself?" By the way, that's a self-contradiction. The universe came into existence, but it caused itself. How could it cause itself if it itself was coming into existence? He's like, "Well, that's just what I think happened. Could have happened. Could have happened. Maybe. Where's your evidence for it? You can't just give assertions. You've got to give arguments, reasons, evidence." You with me? So far, what have they done? Paul, troublemaker. Paul, pest. Paul, evil, wicked, desecrating the temple. Paul's over here going, what's the evidence? Well, they gave a lot of ad hominem attacks. That's Latin for to the man. That's where instead of arguing with the case, you argue that the person is wicked. So you say, "I believe that there's a good case that Jesus is real." And they say, "Yeah, but you're ugly." Okay? That's a good ad hominem argument, fallacy. So what does that have to do? Okay, maybe I'm the ugliest person since the elephant man. All right, it doesn't matter. It could be still true what I'm saying. Paul, on the other hand, not flattery, truth. You can easily verify this, what I'm saying. Verse 11 points out they don't have truth. No evidence for their claims. They can't prove the charges. Verse 13, and I'm not just saying what's true, but what's good. The true, the beautiful, and the good. Good deeds. Gifts for the poor. We get a lot of these accusations as well. Christians have been getting these for thousands of years, quite literally, 2,000 years. That what you believe is wrong, you're at best, you're evil, you're wicked, you're insane, and you're a sect, cult, whatever. And read church history. We're actually in America in a very peculiar bubble that really we haven't faced very much hardship here as far as persecution. But all these things are our friends. Truth, counterarguments, and good deeds. In fact, just this week, we had some of the guys in the ministry houses out in blistering tundra cold, helping out by shoveling the driveways of their neighbors down the street. Big, burly, bearded, alpha men. Okay? You could smell the testosterone for blocks. They were so powerful and burly and manly, the police, the Columbus City Police, cried out for help, and they said, "We will come to rescue you." So awesome, man. So awesome. They were buddies with those cops at the end of it. At first, they were like, "No, you don't need to dig us out." And they're like, "We want to help." And they're like, "All right, fine." So they dug them out and high fives and everything. Man, what a statement. Anybody in this room, one of those guys? Oh, dude, you will have a date by the end of the night, okay? For sure. Okay. Anyways. Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. This wasn't like hardcore, you know, lock him up in prison. This was house arrest. Several days later, Felix came to his wife, Drusilla, who was Jewish. Drusilla, who's this lady? She's young. She's 19 years old. She's the daughter of Herod Agrippa I. You remember him? Acts chapter 12. He was the one that killed James. That's her dad. Her great-grandfather, or rather grandfather, is Herod the Great, the guy who killed all of the innocent babies in Matthew 2. She comes from a whole family of killers. And according to historians like Josephus, she was F-I-N-E. Quote, she exceeded all other women in beauty, according to Josephus. Felix was so smitten, he seduced her away from her husband and convinced her to forsake her husband and marry him. She died with her son in AD 79. You're like, that's very specific. How do you know that? Because she died by Mount Vesuvius. That thing blew, and she was killed 20 years later. So she would have been in her 40s. Right now, she's a teenager. Felix sent for Paul and listened to him and as he spoke about faith in Jesus. Paul talked about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. What do you think a man like Felix was thinking as he was hearing this? Righteousness. Am I really a righteous man? I've spoken to people, and over the years, I've asked the question, so if you don't get forgiveness through Jesus and what he did, then what do you do with your guilt? And you know what I've never heard in response? What guilt? No one has ever shared that before. Everyone knows precisely what we're talking about when we say, what do you do with your guilt? Felix must have sensed, I am not a righteous man. Self-control like not reaching out and taking a man's wife in adultery. He must have been thinking to himself, I wonder what my wife thinks about this stuff about self-control. The judgment to come. If I'm unrighteous, if I've committed adultery, as well as many other moral violations, what is a perfect and holy God going to do with someone like me? Well, we read next, as Paul spoke, Felix became afraid. Oh, yeah, that's how you would feel in a moment like that. That's enough for now, he said. You may leave. When I find it more convenient, I'll send for you. That convenient time never came. Felix was ousted out of rule, and he had to stand before the Emperor Nero in the end. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked to him. Remember, he said he gave gifts to the poor? He probably thought Paul had a really good bank account, so maybe he could just bribe his way out of this. Then we meet Governor Porcius Festus. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. Who is Porcius Festus? He reigned from AD 58 to AD 60, fairly good governor. Roman coinage places him in year 5 of Emperor Nero. This would be Emperor Nero was from AD 54 to AD 68. Year 5 would be AD 59. According to history, Porcius had a monotone voice when he spoke, which made him a real bore. The Jews refused to eat with Porcius because they ate kosher. Porcius was the same way that my wife loves her men. Tender. All right, anyways, Porcius Festus. Don't sound like an ignoramus if you ever try to pronounce his name in class or something. Porcius Festus went down to Caesarea, and the next day he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. When Paul came in, the Jews had come down from Jerusalem, and they stood around him. They brought many serious charges against Paul, but they could not prove them. Then Paul gave his defense. I've done nothing wrong against the Jewish law, the temple, or Caesar. Festus, wishing to do the religious leaders a favor, said to Paul, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem? Stand trial before me on these charges?" Paul answered, "I am standing before Caesar's court in Caesarea, where I ought to be tried. I haven't done anything wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving of death, I do not refuse to die. I'll die. If I deserve capital punishment, kill me. But if these charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar." Basically, he's saying, it's kind of like, you know, I plead the fifth. I need a lawyer. I'm lawyering up. It was a formal declaration. I want to go all the way to the top. After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go." After a few days, we meet Herod Agrippa I and Bernice. They came to pay their respects to Festus. Herod Agrippa II. He lived from AD 28 to 100. He was the final ruler in the Herodian dynasty. He was not really a king. He was a tetrarch over different provinces in Judea. His father was Herod Agrippa I. He was the one that killed James. His great-grandfather was Herod the Great, who slaughtered the infants. He was half-Jewish, so he knew a little bit about Jewish issues, religious issues. This is why we've got the governor saying, "Agrippa, I need your help." His wife was referred to as the Jewish Cleopatra. Beautiful woman. She was the daughter of Herod Agrippa I, and she was the sister of Herod Agrippa II, this guy. Guess who else was her sibling? Drusilla, from the earlier part of the chapter. Drusilla, this is all one big family here, what we're seeing. Her uncle married her at age 13. Gross. After his death, she moved in with her brother, Herod Agrippa II. She moved in with her brother. Juvenal, the satirist, said that they were in an incestuous relationship. He was only 1 year older than her, and apparently they were very close. She became the love interest of General Titus after the Jewish War. This woman was beautiful, but she was used and abused. Terrible. Well, we read, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. There's a man here whom Felix left as a prisoner. When his accusers got up to speak, they didn't charge him with any of the crimes I'd expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus who Paul claimed was alive. So you can tell, he can't follow the Christian view. He's like, can you figure this out? He's a dead man, but he's alive? What's that mean? So Agrippa said to Festus, "I would like to hear this man myself." "Tomorrow you will hear him," Festus replied. The next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room. At the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. Festus said, "King Agrippa, I have nothing definite to write to Emperor Nero about this man, Paul. Therefore, I have brought him before you so that as a result of this investigation, I may have something to write. For I think it is unreasonable to send a prisoner all the way to Rome and to the emperor without having specific charges against him." Agrippa said to Paul, "You have permission to speak for yourself." So Paul motioned with his hand to begin his defense. "King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all of these accusations, and especially because you are well acquainted with all the Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. The Jewish people all know the way I have lived ever since I was a little child, from the beginning of my own life and in my own country, and also in Jerusalem. They have known me for a long time and can testify, if they are willing, that I conformed to the strictest sect of our religion, the Pharisees. Scrupulous men, 6,000 of them. I mean, they were the most religious of all. And he's like, I was one of them. And now, it is because of my hope in what God has promised to our ancestors that I am on trial today. This is the promise our 12 tribes are hoping to see fulfilled as they earnestly serve God day and night. King Agrippa, it is because of this hope that the Jews are accusing me. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? Good question. If there is an infinite personal God, there is no problem with miracles. God can reach into his universe and do anything he wants with it. You say, but no, raising the dead, that's really big. To an infinite being, nothing is big. An infinite being doesn't know the definition of a big miracle. You know, flooding the world, you know, is the same as flooding a bathtub to an infinite being. So raising Jesus from the dead, for which there is ample and persuasive evidence, would be nothing to an infinite personal God. Paul says, I was like you. I was convinced that I ought to do all that I could to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And that's just what I did in Jerusalem. On the authority of the chief priests, I put many of the Lord's people in prison. And when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them to have them killed. Paul, in my view, was very likely a Sanhedrist, part of that inner 70-person Supreme Court. We get it right from there. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished, and I tried to force them to blaspheme. Torture? Force them to blaspheme? I was so obsessed with persecution that I even hunted them down in foreign cities outside of Jerusalem. On one of these journeys, I was going to Damascus with the authority in the commission of the chief priests. At about high noon, when it's really bright in the sky, noon, King Agrippa, as I was on the road, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, blazing around me and my companions. What could possibly be brighter than the sun at noon? Jesus. Jesus appears to Paul. And right there, as we've read, this is the third time Paul has told his story, or rather Luke has told Paul's story about how Jesus knocked him off of his donkey right onto his back and said, why are you persecuting me? Why are you doing that? It's hard for you to kick against the goads. Paul gets up blinded, comes to faith in Jesus, and everything's different. He goes from being a persecutor of the church to being its greatest proponent and preacher. He says, the prophets say that the Messiah would suffer and, as the first to rise from the dead, would bring the message of light to his own people. And not just his own people, but to the Gentiles. Now, how do you think Herod Agrippa, a half-Jewish man, is going to respond to that, that we should bring this message not just to the Jews, but to the Gentiles? At this point, Festus just interrupted. You are out of your mind, Paul, he shouted. Your great learning is driving you insane. I love that. He's like, you're incredibly learned, but you're crazy. Okay, another ad hominem argument. I'm not insane, most excellent Festus, Paul replied. What I'm saying is true and rational. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped your notice, because it was not done in a corner. Caesarea is 50 miles from Jerusalem. If you were in Jerusalem and a resurrection occurred and there were thousands of Jews coming to faith in Jesus, Yeshua, you would know. This would be the talk of the city. And that's Paul's point. This would make no sense to write in this biography here, this historical work, if it wasn't the case that Jesus rose from the dead. King Agrippa, Paul said, do you believe the prophets? I know that you do. He doesn't go right for, do you believe in Jesus? He says, do you believe in the prophets? Because if you believe in the prophets point directly to Jesus. Agrippa said to Paul, do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? Or another way to take the Greek is, you almost persuade me to become a Christian. Almost. Paul replied, short time or long, I pray to God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am. Except, of course, for these chains. Yeah, you don't want to be chained. The king rose, and with him, the governor and Bernice and those sitting with them. After they left the room, they began saying to one another, this man is not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment. Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So what do we learn from our four principal characters in this account? Four chapters of reading. It brings us all down to these three men. Let's begin with our first man, Governor Felix. He said, when I find it convenient, I will send for you. Paul's saying, you can get forgiveness right now. Righteousness, self-control, judgment to come. You never need to know what it's like to stand up in front of a just God. You don't need that. You can come out from under the justice of God and experience forgiveness. And he says, well, when it's more convenient, I'll think about that. He must have sensed that it was true what Paul was saying. Otherwise, why would he be afraid? You're not afraid of things that you think are false, fictions. So he knows it's true. He's got that sense, like what he's saying is real. The problem is, I'm just not ready. Why not? Well, I'm not saying no to Jesus, he might have said. Yes, you are. No. I'm not saying no. I'm just saying I need to think about it. Okay, when I was first dating my wife, we had been dating for a while, and at one point I got up the guts to tell her, I love you. Said, I love this about you, and I love that about you, and I love you. And then there was this long pause. 30 seconds at least. And then she said to me, I'll never forget, thanks. She Han Solo'd me, man, right there in that moment. I love you, I know. Okay, then she said, I love you too. And I'm like, oh yeah, all right, okay, everything's good with the world again, you know what I mean? So what if she said, you love me, huh? I need to think about that. I'll talk to you about that when it's more convenient. When I went home to my roommates that night and I said, I love you, and she said, I'll get back to you on that. They would have known what she meant, right? There's the text and then there's the subtext. She's saying, I don't love you. When Jesus Christ is saying, I died on the cross and I'm giving you the gift of forgiveness, and you're saying, I'll think about it, what's that saying? It's saying, no. I don't want that. I know what you did. I don't want it. It's saying, I'll think about it. Now, I have no problem with people that say, well, I need to get my questions answered and I need to think through this some more. Great, 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 great. I hope you know, though, in the meantime, you're saying no to God. And this is very dangerous to live in this state. Repeatedly hearing evidence and realizing, I think this is true, enough to be afraid. And then saying, no, 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 and no. Here's what the Bible says, 2 Corinthians 6. The right time is now. Today is the day of salvation. If you are here with us tonight and you have been procrastinating on this decision to invite Jesus Christ into your life, to wash away every sin you've ever committed, to give you new life, and to give you a spot in heaven. If you have been waiting on that, don't wait any longer. Make tonight the night where you've got that issue, the biggest issue ever that you could ever decide on, settled. You could walk out of here with 1,000,000 pounds off your shoulders, knowing I'm going right to God when I die. This could be the best night of your life. Okay, Felix, what about Festus? Wishing to do the religious leaders a favor. On what basis did he deny this message? Social pressure. Basically, what he was doing was letting other people do his thinking for him, right? Right? He wasn't really thinking about it. In fact, he's saying, oh, they're talking about this man, dead guy, Jesus. But he says he's alive. He's like not even thinking about what he's rejecting. Instead, he's looking around at everyone else going, do you believe this? No, you don't? I don't either. Oh, man, they've done studies on this. Three lines. You know, line A, clearly longer than lines B and C. And they get the dead subjects lined up in a room. They get 9 out of 10 people to say, when they come around and they ask, which line is longer? Say B. And the death subject is at the end of the line. Line A is clearly longer, but person number one says B. Person number two, B, three, B, 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 B. And it gets to the end of the line. Guess what that person says? What do I believe? What I see with my own eyes? Or what the bovine herd is all said. They're all agreeing in one direction. B. B, I think B is the longest. When it comes to something like this, people are looking at one another, wondering, I wonder what people will think of me. Look, everyone in your life is going to be gone. All of them. Mom, dad, brother, sister, grandma, grandpa, friends, professors, everybody, co-workers, boss, they're all going to be dead. And all of us are going to stand before God. You're not going to have the social security blanket to say, well, I was just going with these guys. Each of us will stand before God on our own. And he's going to say, what did you do with this message of forgiveness? He's going to ask you individually. What are you going to tell him? Festus seems like he was just treating this so flippantly, cracking jokes. I don't know about this. You're insane. Who cares? Trying to figure out what Agrippa thinks. I don't know. What do you guys think? And he did that all the way to hell, trying to get other people to make the decision. Please, please, I beg you, think for yourself. Come up with this on your own and figure out what it is that you believe. Finally, Herod Agrippa II. You almost persuaded me to become a Christian. Oh, the tragedy. That's like, you know, skydiving. My parachute almost opened. You know, I remember watching a football game a couple weeks ago. Got right down to the final seconds. Quarterback, Hail Mary, player catches it, bobbles it. Oh, almost caught it. Almost won the game. Just pounding that AstroTurf. Oh, it was right there. You know what I mean? Right there. And then, I bet that's going to haunt him for the rest of his life. That one thing, he almost got it. To hear about Jesus and almost accept it. And then forever, for the rest of your eternity, realize I blew it forever. Oh, that is a tragedy beyond all conception or human imagination. Can't imagine that. If you're here and you're like, I'm almost there, okay, you might be saying, let me translate, you might be saying, I don't know what you're thinking, you might be saying, I'm waiting for like that feeling in my stomach. You might never get it. God gives evidence, and then he wants us to take a stamp on that. Let me just put this on your mind for you to think about, okay? How much evidence do you need to call out to God? What's really that much of a risk here? If you call out and you don't hear anything, what did you lose? Like, God, if you're there, would you reveal yourself to me? How much evidence do you need to receive a gift? That's what we're talking about here. You're like, well, I'm not ready to commit my life to Christ. I know. I know that. I get it. We're not talking about that. We're talking about receiving a gift from God. That's the way he works. Just to say, I want to receive what you did. And begin a relationship with you. The whole idea of walking with God, that comes later, not now. So if you're here tonight and you're like, I'm right there, Just realize all you need to do is have enough faith. The way Jesus put it was you need to have the faith the size of a mustard seed. Just enough, little bit, just enough to call out to God and say, if you're there, I want to know you. And I want what Jesus did to apply to me. And I want to come into a relationship with you. And when you do that, at that moment, God says, that's good enough for me. It's all I needed to hear. To have the humility to surrender to the love of God. Throw down the pride and just say, I need you. God, I need you. And at that moment, God will come into your life. It's a beautiful thing.